Okay, so our next speaker is Carwill James. Carwill is an activist, educator, researcher, and designer based in Oakland. He spent 3 years organizing in support of the resistance of indigenous peoples to multinational oil corporations and has participated in a variety of mass direct actions against war and globalization. He works with Indie Bay, San Francisco, and San Francisco Bay Area anarchist people of color.
Okay. So, can everyone hear me okay? So I'm really glad to be here today, and I wanted to thank everyone for coming out, and I'm really happy that it felt like we moved not just in the lecture hall format, but in this outside format over lunch, and more balanced today. So I'll try and keep my remarks as short as I can, so there's lots of time for people to talk. I guess I really agree with John that you need to situate, like, when we talk about resistance, you need to put it in the context of what exactly it is that we're resisting. And I think that it's very easy for us to forget that we live in a world that's haunted by colonialism and neocolonialism, and that also we live in both the, like, ideological but also physical wreckage of a lot of, like, state-centered projects, both of, like, initially intended to be resistance projects and those that are intended to buttress empire and centralized power. And there's always a blurring between those two things. And we also face a great deal of both looming and present devastation of cultures, of the global environment, of fractured communities where you have people forcibly migrated over a large portion of the earth. We've lost a lot already, and we're in the middle of, like, even more potential loss. And so the question of whether or not only can we resist systems as they are, but whether we can rise to the challenge of organizing our various societies on this planet in such a way that, like, those things can survive is, like, a very real and present challenge. But I also think that it's not fair just to characterize in terms of resistance, but as a, like, broader process, that there are a lot of interconnected, and I would say recumbent, and I'll come back to what I mean by that, processes of creation of and awareness, processes of diversity and reclaiming of power that are happening even as a lot of forms of power, like local anti-power, if you will, power from the grassroots, are being decimated around the world. So conceptually, what I'm talking about today is what I'm going to call subjectivities of resistance, and I always feel awkward throwing out, like, long words as central to a topic, but I guess what I mean, and other people have called this with equally weird sets of words, a new social protagonism, basically ways of people walking onto the stage of history in a sort of durable, continuing way so as to transform their world. So that is, it's very easy when we're resisting the system as it is to be isolated and atomized, because that's essentially what most systems of centralized power try to do to the majority of people. And to have someone ask you, well, what good do you think doing X action will accomplish? That is to divide up each of our actions into as many individual parts as possible so they can be knocked down and delegitimized so that we can do the work of stopping our own work for them. So I want to talk about how to construct ongoing programs and tactics and strategies of resistance and that are resistant to that because they see that as what they're doing for the long term, and also that are creative in the sense that those identities can be seen as part of the foundation, the grounds for, like, a broader new social construction, a sort of, like, imminent, currently existing after the revolution experience. So, and I would argue that these identities, these subjectivities of resistance are powerful insofar as they come to replace the kinds of, like, atomized identities that we have right now, like citizens or soldiers or patriots or consumers, these kind of, like, passive identities that don't allow us to self-construct what we're doing. And ideally, if we structure that process well, then in the midst of it, they're much more real to people than any of those identities, because they allow people to self-actualize and to decide what it is that they're doing on an ongoing basis in a much more reflective, open, and, like, carrying out their own life force, their own volition in the process of doing so. So I think that there are a number of those new and powerful identities that are rising up and self-reconstructing, both personally and aesthetically, and in terms of community values and vision. And I would argue the most effective ones, like I said, are the ones that form an alternative identity. I'm going to talk about ones from both the global north and the global south, but as a reminder for people, in thinking about these, I think that if you live in the U.S. or you live in the north, anywhere we like look at the rest of the world as this vast commodity to be imported, whether it's religious iconography or labor or minerals or like the kind of visual accoutrements of rebellion, right? That it's very tempting to think that like all of the real stuff that's worth appropriating is like far away from here and we're a really long way from there. And so then we're continually put ourselves back into the role of being consumers of these like revolutionary identities rather than, you know, just like chic and creative identities or the producers of our goods and services. And so I want to encourage people not to reproduce that. So I'm gonna try and have examples that go back and forth. And we talked about overlapping forms of oppression this morning, and I think that the response to them are a variety of forms of identities for resistance, of subjectivities of resistance, whether that's class formation, and I think that class is always collectively constructed. It's not that we are exploited, we're not born into being in a class because of that, but because people organize to create class consciousness, create the idea that we should look out for each other, to create solidarity, to stand with each other. That's why there is anything such as class politics in the first place, because people made it happen. And I think there's some really interesting class formation stuff going on now where people are identifying as being part of precarious work or as being part of a broader class of migrant labor or as being like, and each of those constructions are happening. It could take the form of a search for a new dignity where people who have been displaced from the class system, have been made unemployed, then like organize amongst themselves, block roads, create new communes, things like what John was talking about, and then see themselves as picoteros, not as like the unemployed, this like faceless mass. That there's a transformation of perspective in the process of struggle so that you don't have people just identifying as indigenous or peasants or as like urban revolutionaries who went to fight a guerrilla war, but as Zapatistas, a like new and creative set of identities. And you have long existing semi-durable identities like a lot of indigenous movements that redefine themselves in order to find a way to resist. And some of the first folks that I researched and doing indigenous oil solidarity work were the Huarani and the Cofan of Ecuador, both of whom were totally decimated by Texaco going in the 1970s and 80s, had their population severely reduced, suffered a lot from disease, and both of which used as a strategy the creation of like a kind of whole new kind of indigenous political identity in the process of resistance. So in both cases, there was creation of like new settlements that walked away from an imposed evangelical social order and created like their own kind of new autonomous base. And it's those folks who like showed up, you know, 5 years later to burn down the oil wells in Copan territory. It's those folks who like were able to be energized to be part of this like redefinition of what Ecuador is today. And it's that process of self-definition that I want to talk about. But like I said, I wanted to like draw a focus on how that happens in the North because we shouldn't abstract ourselves away from it. And I think one of the places where that happened is, you know, here in the like coastal Pacific, semi-Pacific Northwest, this massive battle over ancient forests here over the last like 15, 20 years, where you had a lot of people who came into that struggle really committed to not seeing endangered species wiped out, not seeing the end of ancient forests, but maybe not with like a perspective that went significantly broader than that. And then over time, what they did is they innovated a lot of tactics. They created a way to go and live in the woods while defending them for long periods of time. They created like new identities that could appeal to people to come into that process. And also over time, they had to look at a broader social structure around them so that it couldn't just be a matter of like a sort of heroic group fighting on the front lines, but rather there had to be some idea of like, well, what is wrong with the system that it's destroying these places, these like repositories of immense like natural creativity and diversity? What is wrong with the system that these areas are being commodified? And so there became a lot of perspective on capitalism, on industrial society, on the broader society that they were in. And I think there's a lot of also a realization that they needed to engage in like revolutionary change with the rest of society. There wasn't enough to be a group. for there's a need for outreach. There's a need to like build new and radical alliances that you saw, you know, Judy Berry's immense like cross like logger slash forest activist organizing, which the state perceived as so much of a threat, that you had ideologies of revolutionary ecology coming out of this. And that those tactics were then made available for urban struggles. So a lot of mass nonviolent direct action for the last like 5 or 10 years comes out of the tactical toolbox that like the folks who were in the forest innovated, right? And then they came to the cities, they came to like mass direct actions like Seattle, and the cops had no idea what to do with them. Because all of a sudden, you didn't just have those people doing them in an isolated, high risk-taking way, but with like mass action, you had people doing them. So there's this double threat of like numbers and of like a tactical sophistication that played a real role in the anti-globalization and to a lesser extent the anti-war movement here in the US. Another example would be the process of resistance against new incursions of oil in the 1990s. So at the beginning of the 1990s, there are a few communities around the world that like really like on top of their game as far as resisting the oil industry. Like the Ogoni people who managed to mobilize 60% of their population for a day of demonstrations in 1993, or a lot of the Ecuadorian oil resistance, or there are sort of like particular places that were kind of ahead of the game, but they also immediately began this process of networking with other folks who were facing similar struggles around the world. They created a Global South-led global coalition called Oil Watch. They spent a lot of time trading like stories, organizing techniques, forms of practice, but they also like spent a lot of time developing vision about, well, where do we fit in this global scheme? How do we relate to the fact that there's massive climate change going on? And then they put forward a proposal around that, which was to say, okay, there's climate change. It's a problem for the world as a whole. We can't burn all of the oil that we have now. They built alliances with kind of like liberal northern NGOs to say, okay, there should be a global moratorium. And they really pushed that through international forum and negotiation, things like that. And like so many other state-centered projects, it didn't get very far, right? But they had set forward this like concept, and it's not a bad concept. So what they said is, okay, we can't implement this by going to Kyoto. We can't implement this by going to the corporations and asking them to do it voluntarily or under pressure. But instead, what we're going to do is carry it out ourselves. And so what they put forward to other social movements is like, we need this process of cutting off this stream of globalization, really arguing that oil was the lifeblood of globalization, and therefore everywhere that could be resisted and cut off, they could impose their own moratorium. So I think a lot of the main highlights of all of these different forms of subjectivities of resistance have been talked about in terms of horizontalism, in terms of a different view around representation than before. Well, maybe I should talk a little bit about that. That like a lot of the forms of resistance that have emerged don't necessarily focus on like having a single spokesperson, but rather focus on like bringing out a lot of people and making their non-negotiability part of the demand, part of their organizing, and part of the reason why it's hard to repress and isolate them. Because if you have, you know, 500 people blocking a road and no one wants to negotiate until whatever demand is met, then there's no way to like isolate the leadership, there's no way to buy people off, because you'd have to buy off everyone. I think a refusal of isolated heroism and an idea that like everyone can become involved, like some very open organizing structures that encourage and believe in like mass public action, has been a key highlight of that. I think that there's been a refusal to they need to push beyond centralization and certainty, that they needed to invest in an idea that they were not the only people creating a future. Because if you're indigenous in Ecuador, if you mobilize all of the indigenous folks, you still have like the other 70% of society that you have to deal with. But instead saying, we're having this open process, we're going to redefine our society, and you should be a part of it. And I think that what that allows for is that for different portions of a society to push forward change at their own pace, but then also for some to take the lead sometimes and others to take the lead at other times. And I think that all of those are key to us understanding these as a non-state-centered set of activities, set of identities, because they are identifying and pushing past all of these things that anarchists have critiqued about the state and state-focused movements. But the other side of this that we don't talk about is enough, I think, is community within that process of struggle. So that it's not just a matter, when you're building identity, it's not that you go home, it's not like a job, right? Not like, well, we resist, and then we all have our separate lives, right? Like, we resist, and then we have to, like, deal with each other. We have to deal with the consequences of that resistance, and we have to support each other regardless. And some of that comes from, like, some of the difference between, you know, a job and community is that having an open, this open claim of association to say that anyone can come in, and then when people have engaged in risky creative tactics, you create this bond of solidarity that's very real and very tangible for people. Additionally, having lots of different systems of coordination, having places where large numbers of people can interact, being very non-virtual, being very much in public space has been a big factor for that. And also a lot of opportunities for reflection that conceptual, like we can have a conference like this and there are movements that are anarchistic. This is not a conference to direct them, right? But there's a seriousness that says, oh, if someone puts out an article like Where Was the Color in Seattle? Or someone like, there's a series of critiques, a series of conversations going on that we need to bring that back into our work. That's a kind of open, self-reflective community that allows for a different level and sophistication of coordination than could be achieved by having an actual coordinating committee. And so I think that's been important. I also think that one of important aspects about seeing this as community is how many cultural elements of resistance that there are. So that, like, part of the resistance is tangible use of tactics, and part of it is building a culture that opposes, that refuses to legitimize the impositions of society and that legitimizes this new alternate identity over time. And I think that the use of art, the use of music in that process has really been key for forging a lot of these identities. And also just the fact that these movements have tended to use tactics that, like, cross the boundaries of what's legal and what's not has meant that they experience a portion of their lives as outlaw efforts, not quite as underground as those who took straight military violence to the state, but having to create their own infrastructure for food, for health, for looking out for each other, for legal support that is autonomous of existing state institutions. If you know you're going to be violating the law, you guys, you're the ones who have to have the video camera, not the cops, right? If you know you're going to be violating the law, you're the ones who have to, like, provide health care so that your folks don't get arrested in the hospital. And I also think that the last thing I want to concentrate on is that one of the tests of any form of community is how does it face a death in its family? Like, how seriously does it take it and how does it respond to it? And so you can only talk about this with some kind of acknowledgement that there's this incredible differential in terms of media attention and public attention, sense of politeness in the Western and Northern world about which deaths get attention paid to them. And I want to introduce this by saying that, but I still think that there are particular things you can identify about some of these new social protagonisms that are really important in terms of how they deal with death in their movements. Because the fact of the matter is that we're confronting deadly systems of oppression, and we also, of necessity, if we're in a state where we wish to change the world as it is now, facing the violence that we do, we have to take on the reality that the systems we face use lethal violence against us and use other forms of severe violence against us. And so there's enormous risks that are taken on, but we don't have the luxury of being a central committee or a party or something that can say, oh, we are going to have a certain number of people who die and, you know, keep a stiff upper lip and that's the end of the discussion, right? Like, we're much more like open and decentralized effort, so we need to have different ways of being able to talk about it. And the fact that, like, that valuing of the individuals who are taking part in resistance is a shared thing, I think, is often obscured when we have these debates about violence or nonviolence or what form of tactics we're going to use, that there's this overwhelming consensus that the people who are involved in the movement are not expendable, and they're not a currency for winning victory. And I think that that's really important, even as we know that, like, people are killed by the things that we're confronting every day, and people do step forward exactly for that reason, to take enormous risks in the process of resistance. So I think that part of this is a shared understanding that we're going to refuse to be ruled by just the threat of violent force, the fact that people still organized to, like, come out in Genoa when there was this massive threat of violence there, that people still organize in Buenos Aires when there was a national state of emergency declared. They just did that again in Ecuador. There's like refusal of ceding space to these declarations of violence, in part because we know that there's enough human force to resist them. And but that has meant some really serious, like serious casualties on our side. And also, but at the same time, I think that there's been a kind of large and kind of remarkable role for those people who we have lost. So that, to take a most striking example, that in Bolivia during the so-called gas war, this mass social protest in October of 2003, in which I believe 70 people were killed by state violence, like what happened was, as that process was happening, as miners and other lower class people were being shot down by the state marching towards La Paz in El Alto and a number of other places, is that that was the point where they pressed this other offensive to say, okay, we're going to have, you know, 1,000 middle class and upper class people go on hunger strike to say the government must resign, it's not acceptable, these people are being killed. And I think that's a very different response to violence than a state-centered movement that eventually is going to figure out some way to organize and legitimize violence is going to take. And really there's no, as I said, there's no proof of community, like the ability to bury one of our own and carry on. And to, and also there's no proof of living in the in northern society and getting beyond the ideology of living in northern society as to see deaths that happen within our movement as parallel or equal to and is no better than those of people in the global south. And so the best example I can think of that is really what happened in Madrid in last year after Once de Marzo, when there's a massive bombing of commuter trains and 199 people were killed. There's a government thought this is their big coup, we're going to organize, we're going to have a public mourning day, we're going to have this whole thing, we're going to get all these people out, we're going to rally in support of the Constitution, we're going to pin this on our favorite political enemy, the Basque separatist movement, and that fell apart. You had people who were part of the massive, you know, 80% plus anti-war movement in the Spanish state saying very clearly, the wars are theirs and the dead are ours. You had a massive identification of that suffering with the suffering of people in Iraq. And you had this massive pressure to both delegitimize the government's effort to at propaganda to break a point of non-protest, which is what's supposed to happen the day before an election in Spain, and really to really change how people saw the war, and to like eventually, and in the process, kick out a government that had gone to war against the wishes of the people. In contrast with that, I think is what happens when we can separate ourselves from that kind of loss in the global south. And I think that the U.S. movement against anti-globalization movement really has never come to terms with the death of Lee Kyung-hae in Cancun. And I think that there's just been this like total, we don't want to go there, realization of like the abyss that kind of lies on the other side, as much as a realization of the humanity that lies on the other side. And I think, and we need to remember what a role that sense, living in the North, this idea that we're invulnerable, plays in the politics of war and empire for us. So the very fact that we're in this global war on terror after, you know, after September 11th was primarily based on the idea that what we're supposed to be guaranteed is that like our flesh does somehow like doesn't blow up in the U.S. There's so much shock and so much like violence that's available based around that. And it's legitimate in public discourse for generals to say, well, 5,000 of our people died. I don't want to talk about their civilian casualties until 50,000 people die. That kind of like just terror of the flesh that people can experience in the North, and which as one last example is also kind of what preceded the first assault on Fallujah, that four Americans were shown being killed in a very clear and blatant way. There's no doubt that like they were vulnerable as beings of flesh. And that was so terrifying and so like enraging to a northern mentality that refuses to recognize they were all human, that Fallujah really was punished for it and punished severely. So that's a lot of different thoughts, but I'm going to close there.